Introduce yourself, please.
You want me to go first?
You go first.
Okay. My name is Jason Holzman. I am the state senator for the 7th District, which is the city of Kansas City from Truce to State Line, from the river to the Cass County line. So right here, right now, you are sitting in the 7th District. I spent 6 years in the Missouri House before moving over to the Senate. I chaired the Committee on Renewable Energy, and I chaired the Committee on Urban Agriculture. So food security and renewable energy and energy independence have been the cornerstones of my legislative efforts. And I enjoy being in the Senate, and I look forward to another 4 years if I'm so honored with your vote come November.
That was the longest introduction we've ever had in the history of State House Blend, but we're glad, and it was very
You got to keep in mind that when we filibustered SJR 39, I did 14 of the 39 hours myself, so get settled in.
And I believe I'm going to recognize a previous question motion from Senator Rob Schaff. Introduce yourself, please.
I'm Rob Schaff. I'm the senator from the 34th District, Buchanan Counties and Platt County. And mine is actually the best district. Jason's wrong.
Yeah.
And anyway, I'm a family physician.
Let's take a vote.
I usually work on a lot of health issues. I'm on the Budget and Appropriations Committee. Now, this year, I'm the chair of General Laws and Pensions. You know, Jason and I work together quite a bit on a lot of things.
We do.
Which we can talk about. But first, let's play the open.
This is State House Blend. I'm Sam Zeff.
And I'm Brian Ellison. We're using coffee
and donuts
to better understand the legislatures on both sides of the state line,
the issues and the people in Topeka
and Jeff City. Here we go.
And welcome to this live taping of State House Blend. We're coming to you from the Buffalo Room at the Westport Flea Market in this month's installment of KCUR's podcast party. And we have a great crowd here tonight. In fact, normally we have another voice as part of this conversation, and so we do tonight. That voice is our studio audience. Guests on our show always get to enjoy our traditional coffee and donuts. And so a little later when we open this up, everyone who asks a question gets a donut, so be thinking about your questions. But we always start by trying to get to know our legislator guests a little bit. And I want to start with you, Senator Rob Schaff, Republican of St. Joseph. Tell us about your family and pets.
Okay. Well, my family is my wife, Debbie, my son, Robert, who's 27, daughter, Renee, 25. Robert went to Harvard. Renee's at Northwestern. And I have a dog named Jazz. She's a black lab. She gets my paper for me every morning. I also have a little kind of a miniature pin, min pin, you know, dog. And he's a very active, happy little dog. And I have...
What's his name?
And his name is Woody.
Woody, okay. And, Jazz and Woody.
And Woody is named that for a reason. Anyway.
It is a podcast. It's not, you know, the FCC regulations don't apply if you need to tell us what.
I don't
really need to know that.
And then I have four cats. Two of them are outdoor. One of them is indoor, and one of the indoor ones is a black cat that was, we were told that he had feline leukemia virus when we got him and that he would only live for 3 months. And that was like 3 years ago. So.
Wow. What are your four cats' names?
Well, there's Calvin and Hobbs, Tom Tom, and Pepper.
All right. I feel like we know you much better now, Ruff. Thank you so much. Jason Holzman, tell us about your family and pets.
My wife, Robin, is a school teacher in the Center School District. My daughter, Savannah, is 11. My son, Grant's 10. I've got a dog that's a Vizsla named Abby, and I've got a bearded dragon named Reg.
You have a bearded dragon?
A bearded dragon, Rhaegar Targaryen. After the Game of Thrones.
Wow. Okay. I wish I knew something about Game of Thrones so I could ask you more about that. But is that a bad guy or is that a dragon?
You never really meet him because he died the prequel before the show starts. So.
I'm glad that wasn't a spoiler because then we'd really get in trouble. how did each of you get hooked on politics in the first place, or at least get involved in politics? Jason?
Well, I did. The truth is I was put in my mother's womb to do this work. I really believe...
It's quite a bold claim.
No, I really believe that you are designed to do public service or not. And I've always sought a chance to help others. I was a high school teacher in the inner city of Kansas City for 5 years before I made my way to the State House. And it was the time spent, you know, John Edwards' Two Americas in 2004 was a theme that was permeating through the political landscape at that time. And I was living it. I saw the Two Americas. I saw the city of Kansas City school district not be the same opportunities as far as resources go as the school I went to, which is Blue Valley on the other side of the state line. And through that disparity grew a desire to see someone do something to try to make a difference in that. And that kind of drove me into the political arena.
Rob, how about you? How did you get involved in politics? Well,
my problem was trying to get my patients the care that they need as a physician. And there was a big problem with methicillin-resistant staph. And I was fighting that and trying to, you know, make the delivery of healthcare better. And I just kept beating my head against the wall. So finally I ran for office. And that was one of the first things that I did was work on the infection problem.
Wow. All right. You, I should acknowledge that I used to live in the Northland, and you were my senator, Rob, and now I live south of the river, and you are my senator, Jason. So I have a conflict of interest, but it's with both of you, so I think it's fine. So let's talk a little bit about this session. We're now about a week past the end of the Missouri General Assembly session. This is an election year, of course. That led a lot of people to think not much would be accomplished this year, but others had some pretty big expectations for the session. There was a lot of talk about what could be accomplished with ethics rules and with campaign finance laws and with health care and how to pay for it and with election rules and education funding. As you both look back on this session that's just ended, what's one thing that stands out to you? And it could be something that was done or something that was, in fact, not done. Rob, how about you?
Well, the thing that I'm most proud of is something that I worked with Jason on, and that was transparency in the healthcare marketplace. And he had a bill, and I had a bill, and I think both of them made it somewhat across the finish line, maybe with some tweaks. But you know, people go and they purchase healthcare services and they have no idea what it's going to cost under their insurance because it's a secret as to what the allowed amount is. And he had a method and I have a method to make it so that people can actually know how much things cost, you know, before they buy them. And then if, you know, provider A is cheaper than provider B, you can choose A, go save a bunch of money under your insurance, whereas right now, can't do that.
Yeah. Okay, how about you, Jason? What's a big accomplishment or not?
The work that Rob and I did on healthcare transparency is hopefully going to have a positive impact. The ACA helped get folks access to health insurance, but it didn't do anything to lower the cost of that insurance. And so we're, you know, how many of you would have ordered that cheeseburger you're eating right now if they told you they were going to bill you 6 weeks later and not tell you how much it was going to cost? And that healthcare is the only industry where we tolerate that. And it's time for us to make a change there. And so Rob and I teamed up and passed that law. Now, outside of that, clearly participating in the efforts to stop SJR 39.
SJR 39 is the religious shield law that was perceived by some as a way to protect religious freedom and others as a way to discriminate against LGBTQ.
To legalize discrimination against the LGBTQ community. And so being a part of that historic filibuster, you don't know you're a part of it while you're in it. I mean, I didn't sleep for 2 days. I didn't leave the Capitol for 2 days. And it really wasn't something that we were conscious of. We just knew we couldn't let this bill pass. And at the end, the Republican majority used the previous question, which we consider to be a nuclear option in our Senate chamber, and they forced the vote, and it passed through to the House. And fortunately, because of the amount of attention, the national attention that our filibuster brought to the issue, there was enough energy behind defeating it that it carried over into the House, and the House Committee on Emerging Issues, the bill failed there.
9-3. Rob, do you see that filibuster the same way that Jason does?
I'm sure I don't see it the same way. Being that, you know, I was sleeping in my office and he was out there working, but I think I was the only Republican that voted against the SJR. Isn't that true? I think I was.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And why did you do that? Why did you break ranks with your
Just
fellow Republicans?
Some different reasons. I felt that it just is something that shouldn't be enshrined in the Constitution. for one thing. Second thing is the way that it was handled with the PQ really upset me because I don't feel that the Senate rules were followed. And Jason knows, he was there. The Senate rules weren't followed. And then thirdly, I thought it would be just bad for business.
Yeah, there were over 300 Kansas City businesses that joined together in opposing that legislation because of the damage that they felt it would do to the local economy.
You're both talking about PQ, the previous question. That's a motion that happens in the Senate. Now, in the U.S. Senate, when there's a filibuster, the majority party can invoke cloture which happens from time to time, doesn't happen all that often, but I don't think it's really seen as the nuclear option. It's part of business.
It's a different culture.
It's a different culture. Why is it such a big deal for the majority party to exercise its will in that way?
I think it's probably because every senator knows that if you, you know, break another senator's filibuster, then they might break yours. And there are a lot of, you know, I think that probably it's just as important to kill bad stuff as it is to pass good stuff. In fact, probably it's even more important to kill bad stuff.
The Senate is a chamber of equals, and you lose your equality when you lose your ability to maintain possession of the floor. And that's why the previous question, it's only been done 14 times in the last 50 years, and it's been done 12 of those 14 times since 2001 when the Republicans took control of the Senate. And the two times it was done when the Democrats had control since 1973, it did not lead to a truly agreed and finally passed piece of legislation. So we've seen this sort of shift. Term limits have really had a negative effect on the decorum of the Senate. Not only do you lose the institutional memory and the understanding of how the chamber works, but you also get House members, and I was one of them, that comes over where the previous questions used 150, 200 times a session, and you get trained as a majority member that if you don't like what the minority is saying, you just move the question and shut them down. In the Senate, because it was designed to be the saucer to cool the hot tea from the House, we want to have the ability, just like issues like SJR 39, that issue was important enough to the Senate Democratic Caucus to hold the floor for 39 hours consecutively in order to try to stop it.
So on a different kind of measure, Rob, you performed what sounds like it was a one-man filibuster, the prescription drug database issue.
Actually, that's not true. I mean, it's not a filibuster unless it lasts for a couple, 3 hours.
All right. I mean, so maybe it's the threat of a filibuster. But
well, I mean, we just talked on it. I talked to Dr. Brown, I mean, the Senator Brown. He and I conversed a little bit. And, you know, the first thing I did when I stood up was I said, put it to a vote of the people, we'll sit down immediately. And they wouldn't agree to do that. So
let's see, tell me if you agree with this characterization of what that is. There has been a bill before, it's a House bill that would have created a prescription drug database. Supporters say that that's necessary, that 49 other states have such a database. It's used to prevent over-prescription, make sure that people are not getting too much of drugs they shouldn't have too much of, to check possible interactions of drugs that maybe multiple doctors are prescribing for the same patient. 49 states have this. You've opposed it. Missouri is the only one that doesn't have it. Tell us why.
Well, I think that most people don't realize that this is a database where every single citizen's controlled substances will be, you know, reported by pharmacists. Every single controlled substance prescription goes to every person, and over 30,000 people in just Missouri would have a username and password where they just type in their username and password, and then they have access to all that data. Now, of course, they're not supposed to look at other people's data, but you know, most people in Missouri don't really want the government to have a database with that degree of intrusion into their privacy. And next, prescription drug programs in other states don't save lives. I mean, it's never been shown that they're effective at reducing deaths from opioids, and the main reason is that people, you know, when they can't get their prescriptions, they use heroin, and then there's no, you know, controlled measurement of dosage on heroin, and they die of heroin overdoses. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people don't want it. It's an intrusion in your liberty, and it doesn't work. You know, it does, however, do what you suggested, which is stop diversion. And it does it better in states that have a rule that all physicians have to use it. And in states where physicians don't have to use it, it doesn't do so good. Well, the proposal here in Missouri was that physicians don't have to use it. And so anyway, you know, 5 years ago, I stood up immediately when this bill came up. I said, I will sit down if you'll put it to vote of the people. And after 9 hours, they agreed to do that, but then they wouldn't pass the bill because they didn't think it would pass in Missouri. So then, you know, last year I offered up a compromise, one that would protect our liberty, where the doctor would get the same information, only it would be, you know, it wouldn't be personally identifiable. Yeah. And it passed out of the Senate, but then it died in the House, so anyway.
So hasn't made it to the finish line yet. Jason, would you have voted for it if it had come to a vote in the Senate?
Well, I have a very strong libertarian streak in me, and so I worked with the bill sponsor on the legislation, and I had one very simple premise, that I was okay with the prescription drug monitoring bill as long as it was a tool for doctors and not law enforcement. And the second that law enforcement starts using a database to violate your Fourth Amendment right and create any cause for a warrant or for a search, I had a real problem with that. And the sponsor was allowed me to insert an amendment into the substitute, which basically said nothing in this database could be used as a primary reason for a search warrant. And as long as it wasn't a tool of law enforcement, I'm okay with doctors being able to share information with patients that is going to help that patient. So I probably would have voted for it in the end, but I wasn't supporting it when I first was elected to the Senate until we got that provision taken care of.
I'm going to invite folks here in the audience in the Buffalo Room. If you want to start lining up at the microphone, you're welcome to do that. You know, the last week of the session saw a lot of action, more than I think some people expected. A couple of bills in particular that came out and were passed as law included a bill that dealt with guns, the permitless concealed carry bill. Now, if Governor Nixon signs it, or if he vetoes it and the veto is overridden, people will be able to carry concealed weapons without a permit in Missouri. And the House and Senate added stand your ground legislation. In other words, anyone who thinks there's who has a, quote, reasonable belief that their life is in danger will be able to use lethal force, will be able to shoot someone. A lot of folks were surprised that came out of the legislature, especially at the last week of the session. Were you guys surprised? What do you think of that happening?
Well, there was no prioritization of that legislation until the last day. We didn't talk about guns all session. This wasn't something that we knew was going to be the hot ticket issue. It was just we defeated the override, or we sustained the override on paycheck the night before. I think the Republican caucus was stung over that, and they wanted to get a win on the last day, and they saw the gun bill as a way to do that.
Is it that baldly political, Rob?
No, I think that there might be a note of truth there.
he's smiling and laughing for those who can't see him. A note of truth. It sounds like you think this was it was so it was just political.
Well,
it wasn't because out of
no,
conviction.
No, I don't think it was political. You know, the Highway Patrol had sent every sheriff in Missouri a notification that they would be audited and a list of people who had applied for concealed carry permits in their county and that they were going to go and audit them. And basically what it implied was that the Highway Patrol kept the list of all the people who had applied, and that was strictly against the law. They shouldn't have done that. But they were caught in a bind with the FBI. The FBI has a certain interstate compact. And so it was perceived that the real only way around this was with constitutional carry. And you have to understand something about the legislative process. You don't get to amend bills on the last day. It's like up or down, that you have a conference committee report before you. There's no time to make any amendments. It was just take it or leave it. And I think for me, it was the constitutional carry provision, that it's the only way that I could see clear to stop, you know, the Highway Patrol and and the Department of Revenue from violating our civil rights.
I mean, but Jason, do you feel like Missouri is more safe as a result of this legislation?
No, you know, this is a really complicated issue, and it's actually, there's a lot to it if you want to peel the onion and get a couple layers deep. First, when you look at the Second Amendment is not just a worship of weapons or guns. I mean, it stands as that ideological disposition that we're all individually sovereign, that we have the ability to defend ourselves against a tyrannical government, and the Second Amendment is the apparatus in which we're going to exercise that right to be sovereign. And so the Second Amendment is very important, and I support the Second Amendment. Even as an urban Democrat, I support the Second Amendment. But I think that you can, like all amendments, have some regulations to them, and there's some common sense measures that come along with that, with those rights. I have a CCW. I supported the Castle Doctrine. I believe that you have the right to defend your home. Concealed carry permit.
And Castle Doctrine is to defend your own home.
Defend your own home.
Lethal force.
But, you know, I went through an 8-hour course with the Highway Patrol. I went and fired 120 rounds with the sheriff. I got fingerprinted. I had a background check. I have a card in my wallet right now that legally licenses me to carry a gun. I am trained to carry that gun, know the difference between when it's appropriate to use lethal force and when it's not. And that training, I think, is what is now being lost. We require our police officers to go through post-training because when they're in the general public and they're carrying a firearm, they have a responsibility to use common sense to exercise that firearm. And there's a national discussion going on that sometimes that sense is not always used when it comes to the African-American community. And that's with our law enforcement. So what this bill does is it removes any of the requirements for training, and it says any citizen lawfully can now carry a gun concealed where they could carry it open. That is one issue. The second issue is the stay-on-your-ground law, which basically says I have no duty to retreat. And a lot of times politicians get caught up in this tough language. They don't want to sound like they want to be reasonable. If someone holds you up in an alley, they think, wow, I'm going to turn this into the OK Corral. But that really makes your family less safe. If that person was intent on murdering you, you would never see them coming. They would not confront you head on. And this, nationally, we see statistics that show 9 out of 10 times that individual wants your wallet or your keys, and your family's life is not worth pulling a firearm from inside your coat pocket to see which one of you two can shoot faster. And so when politicians start talking about this, you want to go towards the danger and all that, it's really tough talk. And the reality is that young African Americans in my city, in my district, now I recognize that a person on a tractor in the middle of Christian County probably doesn't have the same environment that I do when we're out at night here in our city. To say that their experience with firearms is the same as a city that has 100 murders a year, and that those murders are attributed to gun violence, and then to loosen the restrictions on who can carry, and then to justify the homicide because you feel your life was threatened, it's a circular argument. I'm going to give you a gun. You have a gun. Now I'm scared of you. Now I can shoot you legally. That doesn't make any sense to me. So I don't think the Second Amendment is under attack. I think it's doing just fine. I have the ability to carry a gun legally if I want to. And I think that anybody out there that wants to carry a gun should have to go through training before they do so.
Rob, you agree with that?
I agree with the part that people ought to go through training. And that part I felt bad that was left out of the bill. But like I said, you know, we really didn't have a chance to amend the bill at that point. I didn't expect it to go anywhere because I expected it to be filibustered. But I think that there was kind of a sort of an agreement made, and that I'm sure Governor Nixon will veto it.
So you think it'll be vetoed, but it passed with a veto-proof majority, so it seems likely to become law anyway.
It's possible, unless it's challenged in court. But back to the point on the concealed carry database, this was an issue that sort of drives a lot of this discussion. You know, when you go get your CCW, the sheriff does a FBI background check. The FBI has the information on who has CCW. So this idea that because the sheriffs were going to share that information, now Senator Schaaf knows that I'm not a big fan of databases. I'm not a big fan of big government in general. So I was not pleased that we were sharing that information, except for they already have it. They already have that information when they do the background check. So I don't know that that necessarily holds water as to why we needed to change the gun laws in Missouri.
Okay, we got lots of issues we can talk about, but we're starting to get a line of questions over here. So let me invite members of our audience to ask their questions. Tell us your name.
My name is Allison.
Welcome, Allison. What's your question for Senators Rob Schoff and Jason Holzman?
I'm switching back to the prescription database. I lost a friend in 2009, and it was revealed after she passed that she'd gone to about 6 different doctors and gotten everything from Xanax to OxyContin to Adderall to Percocet, and eventually she just went to sleep and didn't wake up. That's a pretty astonishing statistic that we're the only state in our nation that doesn't have one. And I believe that I've even read that we're having problems with people driving in from surrounding states to come here to avoid being discovered in their states because they have the databases. Certainly from a doctor's perspective, I wonder where the consciousness of that is. I believe that prescription pill abuse has surpassed, isn't it the second lead of cause of death now?
I don't know those numbers, but I appreciate the question. It sounds like it's a question for you, Rob Schoff, and you are a physician. Does it concern you? I mean, this was the argument made by the sponsor in the House, is that this is actually about saving lives.
Well, it is about saving lives, but unfortunately, PDMPs haven't been shown to save lives. And it's a real tragedy when somebody overdoses on medication and, you know, it's just truly a tragedy. The question is that, as Benjamin Franklin said, he who would give up a little, liberty for some security deserves neither. This is purely a liberty versus security issue. The question is, should everybody in the country give up their liberty of privacy of not having their meds on the government database accessible by 30,000 people so that less than 1% of the people would be caught, you know, doctor shopping? Not only that, but it doesn't even require doctors to use it. And as Jason said, he doesn't want law enforcement involved.
I'd like you to clarify when you say other people would have access.
Yeah, there's 30,000 people that are licensed by the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs.
These would be doctors, pharmacists.
Yeah, nurse practitioners, emergency room physicians, dentists. And they would all have a username and password. You know, today in the paper I read that LinkedIn was hacked and 117, I think, million people's username and password was hacked. The databases have been hacked in at least 6 states, and there is no data that's secure. I mean, I immediately said upon talking about this, just put it to a vote of the people, and you know that'll be that. But they wouldn't do it. So,
meaning you expected it to fail, is what you mean.
Well, no, I just think that the poll that I showed was that 70% of Missourians don't want their drugs on a government database. So my question is, if 70% of the people don't want it, should we, the legislature, just kind of force it down their throat because we think it's better than they do, you know?
Let me make two quick points.
Thank
Let
you.
Me make two quick points to your question. First, as I said, once the law enforcement aspect was taken care of, I would have supported the PDMP. But having said that, I polled my district, and my district being a pretty liberal district, it failed 52-48. So 52% of the people of a very liberal district said they would not support the PDMP. And the second thing is that when I was doing research for this, Missouri is not in the top 10 states for opioid abuse, and we don't have the database. So that means that 10 states abuse more than our citizens do, and they have the database. So I don't know that there's a direct link that if we pass the database, and if we did it without the protections that I was seeking, that it would necessarily have the intended results.
I just want to throw in.
Move on. Go ahead.
You know, as a doctor, I really honestly believe that the great bulk of these very powerful painkillers are overprescribed. It's more of a problem of overprescribing than it is, you know. I mean, it's illegal for a person to go and see another doctor and misrepresent, you know, and lie. But the problem is that that's not where most of the deaths from opioid overdose occurs. It's people who go once a month and get a script for 90 pills, from one doctor, and then they turn around and sell those pills for like $50 a piece. A person can make quite a good living doing that, just going to one doctor. They will never be caught by the PDMP.
All right.
I think that's one reason it's not effective.
Let's take another question. Tell me your name.
Hello, my name is Patrick Curry.
Patrick, thanks for being here. What's your question? Don't forget to get a donut, by the way, after you ask your question. All right.
Sure. My question for both of you is, will you be supporting the presidential nominee from your respective parties?
Interesting question. Let me expand that question, too. I mean, not only will you be supporting the nominee, but does it matter to you? I mean, how much do presidential politics matter for you as a person running for a state office? You're not up for re-election this year, Rob. You're in the middle of your term.
No, I'm done. I'm term limited.
This is your last term, but Jason, you are running this year. The question was, will you be supporting your party's nominee, whoever it turns out to be, Jason?
Well, I anticipate it's going to be Hillary Clinton. I've endorsed Secretary Clinton. I think she's got a lot of the experience to, at this point in time, I just don't want anybody to mess it up too much. You know, I worry that Donald Trump isn't prepared for the job. Forget ideology for a minute. We're just talking about the ability to navigate the international community. Secretary Clinton has demonstrated an ability to do that as a senator and first lady. I know that she has a connectivity problem. Clearly, the Bernie Sanders team has pointed that out, that she is not resonating with a lot of the especially younger voters. But I think that once you get just an apples-to-apples comparison between her and Donald Trump coming forward in the general election, that she's going to show the country that really it's not much of a difficult choice.
So you'll support your party's nominee?
I'm going to support my nominee.
Rob Schaff, Donald Trump is the apparent nominee.
It'll be Donald. And of course I'll support him. But, you know, a state legislator, I think the most important thing is who wins out of those two, because they'll have coattails and they'll take statewide elected officials with them. And
is Donald Trump the person you want at the top of your ticket?
the thing about Donald is that when he speaks, I don't think he's automatically lying. You know, he's really telling what he thinks
is
the truth.
Wait a minute,
that was a backhanded.
You don't think he's automatically lying.
No, I mean, when Donald talks, I mean, you get the sense that he honestly believes what he's saying. And, you know, I was watching...
Except for changes every 10 minutes.
I was watching a public forum, and Donald was on there. And I swear this lady asked him the question, what are you going to do about health care? And he said, we're going to repeal Obamacare, and we're going to replace it with something great. And everybody in the room just like applauded. And then they switched over to a shot of Hillary, who really looked like an angry grandma. So, you know, I think that Donald Trump is like a freight train. He's just going to roll over and win. That's what I think.
You think he's going to win?
Oh, I think he is. I think he just knows how to get that applause. And Hillary is an angry grandma.
Jason, you're shaking your head, which suggests to me you don't think he's going to win. But do you think
no,
he's going to win Missouri?
I think Missouri, you know, Claire McCaskill defeated Aiken by 16 points. Jay Nixon won his election in 2012 by about 14 points. In presidential years, Democrats show up in Missouri, and we hold 5 of the 6 statewide offices in our control.
But they don't seem to vote for Democrats for president.
No, they didn't vote for one particular Democrat for president. And if you look and see what is difference, you know, you might understand that Missouri still has a ways to go in terms of joining us in the 21st century. But they'll get there. But they'll get there. It's just going to take some time. And I think Hillary will again demonstrate, because she is a grandma, that she's not going to be too quick to push any buttons that might destroy us. And so I don't have the same confidence with Donnie T, you know.
All right. There you heard it. Thanks for the question. Tell us your name.
My name is Michael Hopkins, resident here in Kansas City. Thanks for being here tonight. It's awesome for you guys to do this. I have an actual question for you, but first, I guess just a funny observation. We're talking about the prescription drug database, talking about security and talking about privacy. When I moved down here a couple years ago, I went to the DMV to get a license. switch my license over, and they refused to give me a license because Missouri participates in a program that shares driving records with every other state in the country, and I was prevented from getting driver's lessons until I had to pay a parking fee up in Iowa that I didn't even know that I had. And I know that driving history is not the same thing as medical data, of course, but in terms of the security and the privacy, whoever hacked LinkedIn and got all of that data, I guarantee was a lot harder than hacking into any of the hospitals in this area, having worked in hospital or healthcare IT. So that's more of an observation. But my question is, so a couple years ago, I started a company with a friend of mine, a guy I used to work with. He lives on the Kansas side. I live on the Missouri side. It's a healthcare tech startup. And we were trying to decide where exactly to register our business. And part of that was researching where we're going to have, obviously, the best tax benefits. But one of the biggest things that came out between Kansas and Missouri was that Kansas has a really great angel tax credit program, where if you're a certified business and you're a certified investor, you get a 50% tax credit for investing in one of these companies. And obviously, I'm not advocating for Kansas's tax policy by any means, but I know that Missouri has considered similar bills that I think are just kind of sitting in a black hole, and I don't know if it's in the House or the Senate. So I was wondering if you guys could give me an update on where that is or what Missouri might be doing to make it easier to start businesses in Missouri.
Well, we worked on Angel and New Market for, I mean, my entire time in the Senate. But what happens is we have LIHTC, which is low-income tax credits, and historic tax credits. And the caps on those tax credits, we end up spending about $600 million a year in tax credits in the state of Missouri. So adding new programs to that without any reform is difficult to do. But the reform is equally difficult because you got some senators that say they want to abolish the tax credit program and others to say that, you know, we shouldn't have any caps on them. And we can never find that happy medium where all sides are going to agree. And until we can get historics and low income under control, new programs face a really hard road in the Missouri General Assembly.
I have to agree with that. And I've been on the budget committee or the appropriations committee for like 12 years and studying the budget. And you have to look at it in its totality. And what he said about $600 million, just that's an appropriation. I mean, it just comes right off the top. And we can't spend it. And every year our Medicaid program grows, and you know, exponentially. This year, the growth in Medicaid exceeded the growth in revenue. And, you know, so we ended up having this gigantic $500 million supplemental appropriation bill for the current fiscal year. And it just is really hard to want to appropriate more money for things that haven't really been proven to work. While you might have some anecdotal evidence that, you know, it works here and it works there in Kansas, there have been studies, for example, the Heartland Institute, that say that tax credits just in general are ineffective. They're poor. They're wastes of taxpayer dollars.
And let me also say, too, that, you know, when we look at the numbers between Missouri and Kansas, because I've been very involved with the border war, the economic incentive border war, trying to stop that ridiculous practice, we are winning. And it's not a matter of winning the particular jobs that we have allocated those incentives for. It's a matter of winning the overall global picture of, you know, better employment. We're our numbers, our growth is better. We've got twice as many citizens. We've got twice as big budget. We're balanced on our budget. We don't have the budget crisis they do. And when companies are looking to settle in a state, they're called site selectors. They really look at infrastructure, transportation, education, the ability to produce a strong workforce, and we're excelling in a lot of those categories. So we don't have to, you know, lower our tax rates to try to attract people to our state. People are coming to our state because they want to come to our state.
They also look at the overall tax structure, and Missouri is a favorable overall tax structure.
Right. Yeah, completely agreed. I mean, I can just like, I mean, it might be anecdotal, but I mean, we got our investors over $180,000 in tax credits. We wouldn't have gotten that money from most of our investors if that hadn't been available. And all I know is that Kansas maxed out on their tax credits last year and then ended up doubling the program this year. So I agree that most tax credits are probably not worth the money that they're appropriated for. I'm just curious on what the other plan was.
Yep. All right. Appreciate it. Have a donut. Thanks, Mike. Tell us your name.
Hi, I'm Amy Shoemaker, and I actually live in Lawrence, and so I'm coming from the other side. But my question's more of a theoretical nature. I just moved here in August, and upon moving here, I discovered and was disheartened to discover that although Missouri has the processes in place for statewide citizen-generated initiative and referenda, Kansas does not have that. And so as legislators, I would love to hear your opinion on the utility and the value of not just, because Kansas does have the processes for the legislature to put ballot measures on there.
Do I get to go first?
But on the citizen-generated legislation in particular is what I'm curious about.
So initiatives.
We both worked on a bill that we knew could make it to the legislature.
We've worked together on ethics and anti-corruption legislation, and so it's really important to both of us. But, you know, as a legislator, I've gone to Jefferson City now for 14 years, and I've watched special interests come in, and through the power of their campaign contributions, ultimately thwart good public policy from being enacted over and over, 100 times, 1,000 times. And so I realized that sometimes the only way to get good public policy is to go around the legislature, and that's the initiative petition. And so you're going to see some, I mean, there's a whole bunch of initiative petitions this year that people will get to vote on. And one of them will have to do with campaign contribution limits.
Right, campaign contribution limits. We've tried time and time again to attach them to ethics bills, even going as far as killing ethics bills because they won't accept the campaign contribution limits. Transparency in the 504, the dark money that's out there right now that nobody knows who is spending on candidate elections is
a problem. Stop gifts. I actually appealed the ruling of the chair this year, and that was kind of
They don't
of
know
exciting.
What that means.
What does that mean?
That's a big deal.
You do that. What was the implications of you doing that?
Losing my chairmanship maybe.
Could be a problem.
It's a problem. Well, but we backed out of it and everything was good.
One of the issues that you're going to get a vote on this November is medical cannabis. And we tried to get cannabis through. I sponsored it. Rob and I sponsored,
it too. Yeah.
We sponsored it together. It's funny that
I did it in the House.
Well, and it was honest. It was one of the most modest possible marijuana legalization bills of any state that has approved it. But it died in the House.
It died in the House. Never made it to the Senate. And it did so largely because a lot of the Democrats knew that the signature gathering process was going well for the ballot initiative. The ballot initiative is a much more robust piece of legislation. It's going to be in the Constitution, so the supermajorities can't come back and change it next year. And we've seen the polling on it. 70% of both parties say it's time for us to reform our cannabis laws in the state and the nation. And the legislature simply would not do it. And so this is a perfect example of where you have an issue where the people are ahead of their elected officials, and they have to take the lead in making that happen. And they are, and so this November, hopefully, they turned in enough signatures. They needed 167,000. They turned in 270,000, so 100,000 more signatures than they needed, and hopefully we'll get a chance to vote on that.
And you're not in Kansas anymore.
There you go. Amy, thanks so much. Have a donut. One more question.
Hi, my name is Kelly Kent, and I have a question and a comment.
All right.
The question being, I'd love to hear both of your opinions around Medicaid expansion with the, you know, huge numbers of working poor in Missouri. How do we justify not expanding Medicaid to serve folks in Missouri in a greater way?
Well, you're not going to answer that question.
Well, I just want to talk about the coverage gap.
And then the comment that I would just like to pose to both of you is, the discussion earlier about Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, being elected officials from our state and one of you representing myself in the Northland, I would just ask that both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are grandparents, and Hillary Clinton definitely has much more experience working in government than Donald Trump, and I don't think Donald Trump has done anything to really prove otherwise. So calling her an angry grandma, I just feel is disrespectful. So I would just ask that folks think about that. Thank you.
I didn't actually call her an angry grandma. I said she looked like an angry grandma on the screen there.
That may not be any more satisfactory from Kelly's perspective, but I appreciate that. But the question about Medicaid expansion, I mean, there's federal dollars on the table Why is Missouri not expanding its Medicaid claims?
It's because the federal dollars on the table come with a string that, in my opinion, would bankrupt our state. And it isn't true that they're just free federal dollars. You have to remember that all that tax money has got to come from somewhere. And there are so many facets about the Medicaid expansion that people don't realize. It would allow people who are living actually below the poverty level to continue living there while giving able-bodied people the ability to get free health care all the way up to like 133% of Medicaid, I mean of the federal poverty level.
But there are clearly, maybe I think it's clear that there are some who would benefit from Medicaid expansion.
Well,
and
sure.
You're saying that it's a trade-off you're not willing to make to benefit those folks. What's at risk by supporting
Medicaid
expansion?
What's at risk is the financial health of the state of Missouri. I mean, you know, even with the proposal that was made a couple years ago, we would have to come up with like $240 million to pay for the expansion. And, you know, where are we going to come up with that money?
Jason, is that how you see it?
No. Well, first, let me say that I think that D.C. missed an incredible opportunity with the political capital coming in 2008 to really reform the healthcare system. The ACA definitely took some steps forward with some of the nuanced access of healthcare, but it was the same lobbyists for the insurance industry, for the medical profession, for the lawyers, same lobbyists that have gotten us in this quagmire that helped the congressional members write a bill that they had to pass before they read it. And so I felt like we missed an opportunity to get a public option. We really could have gotten a public option through. We missed an opportunity to have a serious conversation about a single payer system, which both of those would have been better than where we're at today.
But with where we're at today, but Medicaid expansion is the way that a state gets more dollars into its system for healthcare, right?
What we're really talking about is that coverage gap. So there are a lot of workers that fall in between. They work 40 hours a week, but they don't make enough money to actually have an insurance plan, but they make too much money to get on Medicaid, and our Medicaid requirements are very, very limited here in the state of Missouri. So for those folks that are showing up and doing what we asked them to do, which is put in a 40-hour work week, they're getting lost in the cracks. And Medicaid expansion is for them. So when you hear Republican talking points saying Medicaid expansion is welfare for folks who don't want to work, that's just not true. It's not accurate. And so we would like to see that. There are conservative ways to expand Medicaid that other states have shown us. There you can do federal block grants. Senator Ryan Silvey from North Kansas City had a proposal that would limit the exposure that we would have for additional costs having a federal block grant. It's just because it's associated politically with President Barack Obama, and Obama's name is so damaged in the rural community and the Republican right base that they are afraid. They're afraid to touch it. They're afraid to make any changes. They're afraid to discuss it. And that fear comes from a perceived backlash from their base politically if they do.
That's not how I feel. I mean, it's just wrong. And from my point of view, it's that we can't afford it. But, you know, we did actually expand Medicaid this year, and we expand it every year, every day almost. There are new drugs added to the formulary. This year, we increased the asset limit so that a person, instead of only being able to have Medicaid with $1,000 in the bank, if you're disabled or elderly, you can have up to $2,500. And then I think that we need to look at the big picture. You know, our country's $19 trillion in debt. I think that we're on the verge of a financial recession calamity kind of a thing. And as the chairman of pensions, I can tell you that just about every pension plan that we have is seriously underfunded. So,
wow.
I mean, it's
okay.
a big problem.
We could talk for hours.
I know
about
we could. Last point.
Quick.
2 years ago, the Republican majority passed a tax cut. Now, we have 6%, the highest margin tax rate in the state of Missouri is passing since 1933, I believe, is when it was put in place. They rolled that back by 0.75 points. We're $175 million underfunded in our transportation budget. We're $400 million underfunded in our education budget. We could cover these folks under Medicaid expansion, but again, it comes down to electoral priorities. When you have term limits, and that elected official stops representing their constituents and they start representing a new batch of constituents that they want to vote for them, a la statewide politics, you start driving the agenda based on electoral politics. And that's what we've seen. Not as bad as Kansas, but still not as good as it could be.
You're suggesting that politics drive the policies that get approved by the legislature. Is that what you're saying?
I'm suggesting that's what's happened.
All right. You heard it here first, folks. This is the last question.
Thank you for taking it. Hi, I'm Danny Ball, and I live up on the west side. My question is about gun control, and specifically in December, the New York Times released a study that showed in the years since 2007, when Missouri significantly loosened its gun control laws, and 2013, compared to the previous 6 years, its gun homicide rate jumped by 16%, while the national gun homicide rate dropped by 11%. And with that in mind, considering that study's less than 6 months old, I was wondering why the Missouri legislature felt now was a good time to loosen gun control laws further.
We've talked a little bit about the gun law, but to respond to that, there's concern that this doesn't improve safety. Is that a concern to you?
Sponsor of the bill is running statewide. I mean, that's you get base politics. When you're in a primary and you're trying to get far to the right of who you're running against, you get legislation like this that is generated for the sole purpose of trying to get people to vote for you.
Is it purely political?
You know, the thing is that this is another liberty versus security issue. And while the statistics might lean in the direction, I don't know whether those are statistically significant or not.
It's a 27% jump against the national average.
Well, that doesn't really mean anything if you don't know whether it's a raw number or based on a raid or exactly what. The population of Missouri went up. I don't know whether it went up by 16%, but... You know, I mean, you just can't make public policy based upon individual statistics like that.
All right. Appreciate your question. Thank you. You've got a donut. That's good. Before we go tonight,
always... Did we get a donut?
Yes, there will be donuts for the senators. Fear not. But in the meantime, we always end the show by asking our legislator guest to choose a song, their favorite song. It's how we end the program. But this time, we have two guests... So you each get to choose a song, and the audience will decide whose song will play us out tonight. I'm going to start with you, Senator Jason Holzman, Democrat of Kansas City.
This was an agonizing choice because I think that the song that you select should reflect how you're feeling at the moment. And given that we've come to the end of session, being a member of 8 members of a Democratic caucus who stood up against a lot of really aggressive attacks on my constituents by the Republicans, I picked Tom Petty's I Won't Back Down.
All right, strong contender. Senator Rob Schaff, Republican of St. Joe, what's your choice?
Well, after the session is over, I feel good. So I choose The Sun is Shining by Bob Marley.
All right, we've got Tom Petty versus Bob Marley. We're going to do this by the sound of applause, and I'm going to look to our producer, Matt Hodapp, to make his judgment based on the sound he hears in the booth. First of all, those in favor of Tom Petty's I Won't Back Down. not that loud, actually. Okay, those in favor of Bob Marley's The Sun is Shining. We're going with Bob Marley. The sun is shining. Congratulations. Hey, thanks to both of you for being here tonight. Thank you so much. Big hand for both of our senator guests. Statehouse Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. We had help on tonight's event from Mike Russo, Brianna O'Higgins, Cody Newell, Kyle J. Smith, Chris Pruitt, and Sam Zeff. Thanks also to the Buffalo Room here at Westport Flea Market and V-Tran for all his help tonight. You can find us on iTunes or on kcur.org/statehouseblend. And if you use Twitter, that's a good way to keep track of the show. I'm at PTS Brian. You can follow my co-host, Sam Zeff. He's at Sam Zeff. He covers the Topeka, Kansas side of things. We try to use the hashtag StateHouseBlend. This podcast will be up this weekend. You can find a shorter version on the air on Tuesday mornings as part of Up to Date at 11 a.m. on KCUR 89.3. If you have any other thoughts or to be on the show as one of our citizen guests, shoot me an email. I'm Brian at kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. Thanks for coming, everyone. See you next time.